Welcome to Recurring Nightmares, episode 72. I am Chris, as always, joined by Jeff.
Good evening.
And we have a doubleheader of Stephen King adaptations coming your way. But before we get there, we always kind of talk about the movies we've seen over the last month. There's been some stuff. We've both seen a few things. So Jeff, what have you been watching?
I've seen so many things, like movies and TV and stuff, and so we're not going to get to them all. And I still haven't decided what we're going to get to. But there's one movie I really wanted to talk about because I think it's really good. I think people should see it. That, Chris, is called Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie. And I don't know if you've heard of this movie or know anything about it whatsoever.
I have heard about it. I heard it is a comedy. It's also based on a web series and a short-lived TV show, maybe?
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct. I think you have the facts correct. Yeah, so there was a web series called Nirvana, the band, the show. And I think it did get picked up by Viceland for, you know, it's like in limbo now. I don't think you can really watch the show.
Okay.
This movie kind of acts as a series finale for it. I have never seen the show. I had no prior knowledge going in. I don't think you need it. It works just fine.
You don't need it. Like everything I've heard said about it is like, just watch it. It's a good time regardless of your interaction with it beforehand.
Yeah. The only thing I had known about this filmmaker, Matt Johnson, beforehand is he made the movie Blackberry from a few years ago, which was very good. Like, it's one of those few, like, you know, corporate biopic movies that I would say, like, it's really worth checking out. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is their new movie, his new movie, and it is kind of like a Borat-style movie where, like, it's filmed kind of guerrilla style on the street, you know, and so you'll have reactions from like normal people in the background, but it has even more plot than Borat. And it's about these two guys who they want to have a band and they want to have this band play at this like small club. It's like their dream. And I guess that was the premise of the show as well. The thing I would compare it to, not having seen the show, but just like, you know how like there was Wayne's World, like there, you know, it was a bunch of, you know, bits on SNL, and then they did a movie. Like, this is kind of like that.
Okay.
But what's insane about it is like, because it has this low budget and this guerrilla style, there's things that they do in it that you're just like, I don't know how they did that. Like, So that's like basically all you know about it is it's a fun like buddy comedy and based on a show. Yeah.
That's it.
Well, they accidentally go back in time to 2008 and it's like a time travel comedy, and as it goes on it becomes more and more basically Back to the Future 4. And there's a part when they go back into 2008 where they sneak into their old apartment and they're interacting with their younger selves, and their younger selves are clearly their younger selves. Like, it's not de-aging. It's not some sort of like wizardry or whatever. It's like, there's this old footage of them and they're like having conversations about the plot of the movie in this scene. And I'm just like, how the fuck did you do that? And I heard I got this from the film cast, like some interview the director did, and he said, you know, one of my favorite Penn Jillette quotes is like, the reason magic works is because nobody believes that a human would spend that long working on a bit. And so I'm like, did they like literally plan this movie like fucking 15 years ago? And like I don't know. It's just like, there's things in it like that where you're just like, wow, like I like really kind of surpasses your expectations for like the genre that they're working in. You know, kind of like, this is well more, like, way more than, like, a Jackass movie, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the movie it's very funny. I'll give one joke away that I like. So part of how they realize they're in 2008 is that they go in a movie theater and The Hangover is playing. And everyone is like laughing at and like quoting back to the screen like the homophobic jokes that they're doing. And so the one guy's like, wait a second, dude. Something ain't right here. It's just like the best way to figure out you're back in 2008. And I think as it goes on, like the time travel stuff gets to be really clever. And so like if you're into like zany time travel shit, you're totally gonna dig this. Yeah. It's just like really smart like time travel plotting as it goes on. And it's like not what you're expecting when the movie starts, because it just looks like a Jackass movie. And like the other thing I would say about it is it actually like kind of out of nowhere like almost gut punches you by being like really sweet at times and like, you know, like heartwarming. So It's a big recommend for me. It's like I think it's a must see. I think it's one of the best movies of the year so far.
Nice. I will add it to my list.
Yeah, I really hope you watch it, and I can't wait to hear like what you think about it. Like it was a movie I like really liked when I saw it, and then like the more I think about it, I'm just like, man, that's like such a crazy feat that they like made a movie that good on such a like guerrilla style and low budget. Like it's just crazy. Fuck, man, what else have I seen? All right, and I'll be like a little shorter with some of these. I'll throw a couple quick ones out. Primate.
Yeah.
I thought it had really good kills, and it had a really awesome like synth score, kind of like John Carpenter sounding.
Yep.
Dug it. The Housemaid, I fucking love.
Yeah, Housemaid's fun.
You know I love that genre. Like we did an episode on that genre here with a Sydney Sweeney movie.
Yep.
And I just really enjoyed The Housemaid, and you know, I'm going to try to keep these short. But like what I love the most about Housemaid is there comes a point near the end of the movie where like the movie could just end, and instead it's like, no, there's going to be a half hour of comeuppance, and I really enjoyed that, where the tables get turned.
Yeah,
it's good. You know, fun twists. I was trying to figure it out. I was, like, texting you as I was watching it, trying to figure it out. And I was getting closer and closer to figuring it out, and then it's like, aha, I see. So, yeah, if you like that genre, it's a really good example of it. We don't get a ton of these movies anymore. Although I guess we're going to get The Housemaid 2 and 3, because I guess it's a series of books.
Yeah, it's a trilogy of books, so... Yeah, there's a possibility that, and it did well. So
yeah, they set it up at the end.
Yeah,
and I see them doing another one of these, and sign me up. I'm so in. Yep. I guess I'll hold the other movie I saw because I know you've seen it too, and we'll talk about it together.
Okay.
I checked out the first episode of a show on Netflix called Something Very Bad Is Going to Happen.
Okay, that's something I thought that was a movie, but...
No, it's a series.
So I'm less excited for it now. Something I was going to... It's like, that sounds cool.
Yeah.
I'm going to watch that. I didn't realize it was a series, but...
It's a series, but I think it's an 8-episode limited series. I think it's like a one and done.
Okay.
So I've only seen the first episode because I can't really speak to like how good it actually is, but the first episode definitely like is trying to deliver like a scare a minute. Like pretty much all of them end up being fake outs. It's like this couple, they're about to get married and they're heading to where the wedding's gonna be, and they're like going to the groom. His family has like a winter cabin that they go to. It's like fucking baller shit. Like his family's rich. And the first episode is like them trying to get there. And so it's just a bunch of like, they're at a rest stop and creepy shit's happening. They stop at a bar, creepy shit's happening. And you're like, everything ends up being like kind of nothing, or maybe it could be something, you don't know. But then when you get to his fucking house, and his family's like already there, and you start meeting them, and they are all like extremely off-putting. Excuse me. So I think it's going to be like a, like once it got into like, okay, this is what it's going to be, we're at this house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like a Get Out situation. Like something's up with his family. They're not right. And the last scene of episode one, Jennifer Jason Leigh shows up as his mom. So I'm excited to see what they do with her in it. But, nice. You know, fun first episode. I just can't make any strong case for it one way or the other, based on what I've seen. I do plan to keep watching it.
Maybe I'll check it out as well.
Paradise, which I think you should definitely check out.
Yeah, it's one I was like, I got rid of Paramount Plus this month finally, so I was like trying to finish up a show I was watching on that before,
closing
that out, and now I can open it back up and watch Paradise.
I don't think Paradise is like a particularly good show, and and like, you know, like we've brought this topic up before, like what does prestige TV even mean?
Yeah.
And to me, I don't know. You know, when you see it, and this is not prestige TV, it's goofy. It's big, dumb, goofy, and takes wild swings. And it's just like, it'll just drop crazy fucking things. We're just like, okay, I guess. But because of that, because it's not even like really trying to be good most of the time, it's pretty entertaining. Like, I don't know how to explain it. And I just like, knowing your sensibilities, I just could picture you like really liking the show, because the show kind of mixes action and sci-fi and like really crazy plots, you know. And I just think that I usually see you go for stuff like that. So I just think you would really like it. You know, the big spoiler of what the series is about is already known at this point. I think I told you this last year. Mm-hmm. It's like the world has ended. Everyone's living in this like fake city in a bunker. You know, it's like, you know, there's a fake sky dome and all that shit, right?
Yep.
Season two, we get out of the bunker a little bit, and or quite a bit actually, and see what's going on up on the surface. And in Paradise fashion, there's more twists and turns to come. And by the end of the season, we're dealing with AI and possibly time travel, or possibly, right, like,
there we go. Yeah, I'm in.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like, it's so ridiculous. Like, and I'm like, and the thing is, it's pretty popular. Like, there's like a bunch of people at my work that talk about the show, including people that don't really watch like as much TV or movies as me.
I wonder, and,
like, they all really dig it.
I wonder, because like prestige TV also is like, I need to watch this, right? Like, and like, this sounds like a show that, like, hey, I don't need to like sit down and watch it every night or every, you know, I don't know how they released it, but it's like, I can just catch it as I catch it and have a good time with it. And like, yeah, we used to have TV shows like that. And
you know, that phrasing is in, like, important, specific. It's a throwback, much like The Pit is a throwback. It's a throwback, dude. It's a traditional old school TV show.
Yeah,
but it has, you know, the budget, and it has, you know, it could be R-rated as much as it wants. I guess the one last thing I'll say about season two is my favorite storyline in season two was about this mailman who like somehow survived the apocalypse, and he's living on the surface. He's living in his post office. And in fact, there's a whole episode called The Mailman, but his story like extends beyond that. And I really liked what they did with him in that. And I was like, kind of like, that arc was my favorite like part of the season. And then I get to the end and I'm like, I don't even know what's going on anymore. I'm like, I guess you'll explain to me in season three what all this fucking shit is a year later when I don't remember anymore what the fuck is going on. So,
or cool. Or just like old school television, they won't, right? Like, Lost never came to a satisfying conclusion. But it was like, it just kind of strung you along for, I don't know, what was that on, six seasons or something? And four of them were pretty fucking good. Like, they're not good, but they were entertaining. They were fun. Like,
I never watched Lost, but I've heard people compare it to Lost. So, yeah, okay. You were a Lost fan?
Yeah. I mean, I think like season three was where it just started kind of falling apart for me. But yeah, it's like fun up until then, and you jump the shark at some point, and it's like, all right, a minute till the end, I guess. But
this show is all about jumping the shark. But yeah, I think I'm right on this. Like, I think like I just the whole time I'm watching it, I'm like, I enjoy this. I think it's bad. I enjoy this, but I think Chris would love this. Like, it's so crazy, and so I'm very interested to see what you have to say about it.
I'm gonna watch it.
My favorite thing about it, though, is James Marsden as the president, which you don't get as much of, especially in season two. But throughout, you don't get it much because he fucking dies in the first episode. Like, he's dead at the start. He's dead at the start of the series. So every scene you get with him is flashbacks.
Okay.
You're just like, I wish season two found ways to have more flashbacks with him, because he is great as this like kind of like functioning alcoholic womanizer president. Who also like has a good JFK. Heart. Yeah. He's basically JFK. And he's got the look down too. so yeah, like, he's all these like bad things, but he also has like a good heart and thinks about like what the role of like, you know, what the role like the president should have in like calming people down or making like really important. Like the best episode of the series is in season one. And it shows the day that the world ends. And it, like, it follows him like having to figure out what to do. And that was the one episode, like, you could talk to other people, too, that say, like, that episode felt prestige. We're just like, God damn, like, we went to another level here. Like, and it'll do that occasionally. Sometimes, like, the show does, like, elevate above what it's doing. But then a lot of it is just, like, crazy, bombastic. And we're ending episodes with, like, slow, like, serious versions of famous pop songs. Like, you know.
All the tropes.
Yeah, it's doing all the things. And so, yeah, if you want something fun like that, I recommend it. I think you'll get a huge kick out of it. And I guess I'll leave that at that. I just a bunch of shit there.
All right, so I got three here. Start off with the two that are very similar, I guess. Ready or Not 2, Here I Come. You are not a Samara Weaving fan. You are now. Okay, or you just don't like the films she's been in? Is that because like she's
so Samara Weaving fan? Have I found her movies? I can't even tell you what movies she's been in really off the top of my head, but I think she's like so beautiful. I think she's so pretty in this movie.
Okay, so I think I'm crossing her with somebody else in horror films that.
I know what you're thinking of. You're thinking of the Happy Death Day.
Yeah, that's not her.
I don't like her.
So, well, Ready or Not 2, sequel to Ready or Not, which is kind of like, that was it's a hunt movie. Like, she is hunted by this family, and she has to survive till sunrise, and if she does, she'll live and the family dies because they've all pledged themselves to Satan. They expand on that here where it was like there's a clause that, well, one, there's like a cabal of like rich families that are in charge of the world, and when this other family dies because she survived, it opens up a power vacuum, and they need to play the game again, but now it's all of these families have to hunt her. And basically, if she survives again, she will be the one to take over and be in charge of the world. So it's all these people like just hunting her down. The cast is pretty crazy. It's like Sarah Michelle Gellar, Elijah Wood, David Cronenberg is in it for a short period of time.
Yeah.
He plays the dad of Sarah Michelle Gellar and this other dude. This adds on to the kind of the concept by introducing Catherine Newton as the sister.
Like an estranged sister of
Samara Weaving. Yeah. So Samara Weaving's name is Grace. Catherine Newton's character's name is Faith. So they're Faith and Grace, just very cheesy. And they do the hunt again. They have to play hide and seek, and they're trying to kill her. They're doing it on this like wide open hotel grounds, resort grounds. It's fun. I think it is most fun in like the first half. It then takes like a weird, dark turn, where we kind of like really find out like who the main villain here is. He's this he's the brother of Sarah Michelle Gellar, Titus, and he is just like a sadistic fuck. And like there are extended scenes where you see him beating up Faith or Grace.
Yeah, they intercut it with another fight.
Yeah.
And they're playing this like they're playing a total eclipse of the heart over it. Yeah.
So like it's and jarring. I love the fight. It's,
like you found that scene jarring? Because I found it jarring.
It's super jarring because Grace's fight with the lady is comedic.
It's appropriate to have that music playing over it. It's supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
And but then it cuts to like him beating the shit with
bear spray. Yeah, and he is beating the fuck out of Faith, and it's like this is brutal, like, and not fun. Like the other fight is fun. It's like, what am I? How am I supposed to feel here?
Yeah.
It's a very, very weird scene, and that's kind of where it was like, eh. But it does turn around, kind of like for the finale. There's a fun finale. Is the way she gets out of it again. I really like the addition of Catherine Newton here. I think I like the addition of Catherine Newton in anything. I had fun with it. It was a good time.
Yeah.
You saw it too, so.
Yeah, and like if I'm just a normal person that doesn't regularly give my opinion on movies, like, you know, if we're walking out of the theater, I would have said, yeah, it's all right. It's fun. It's entertaining. But yeah. Since I'm not paid to have takes, but I do give takes, the more I thought about it didn't impress me. I was just like, yeah, it's fine. Mm-hmm. But the more I thought about it, I'm like, one, I think I'm done with Radio Silence. I've always disliked them because they call themselves Radio Silence. I know it's like a little nitpicky thing, but I just don't like it.
Yeah.
I think I'm done with this type of humor. In horror movies, like it's kind of Marvel-y.
Yeah, a little bit, sure.
And you know what else I think I'm kind of getting sick of a little bit is this like cartoony depiction of the billionaires. Not that like I'm here to defend the billionaires at all. I just feel like we've had shows that do it so much better than this. Like shows like Succession. Or Industry, where like they're still awful people. They're absolutely awful people, but they're like three-dimensional.
And yeah, everybody in this is like a caricature. Like yeah. there's no depth.
It just feels lazy to me at this point. Yep. Like I get it. Like the billionaires are bad. You know, I hate them too. Also, by the way, the main baddie here, he plays Dr. Abbott on The Pit. Mm-hmm. And so it was really weird seeing like this rock star doctor be the bad guy here. Like it was hard for me to separate him from his character on The Pit because he's so awesome on The Pit. He only shows up like so the first two seasons of The Pit have been like during the day shift, and he works the night shift. So you'll see him in the first couple hours and the last couple hours, and he just rolls in. Like there's a scene in season one where he's like working on a patient and also giving blood to the patient from himself. I'm just like. He's just like total. Every time you show up, you're like, you know, this guy's gonna handle the fucking business, right? and just seeing him here playing like this, like kind of goofy bad guy, like he's so good on The Pit, even though you don't get a ton of him. That and then here I was like, I don't know if I like him in this, like I don't know. And then when he's beating the shit out of Catherine Newton, it's like, Jesus, dude, what the fuck? Anyways, I don't hate it. I thought it was fine. It was like. Yeah. The time went by quick. It was okay. But, like, if I had to say things about the movie, it would be the things I just said.
Yeah. Yep. Agreed. Weirdly, I think this hurt it a lot is another film that I saw. I just saw it on Monday. It came out over the past weekend. They Will Kill You is kind of the same thing.
That's like what I've heard.
It is a movie where this Zazie Beetz plays this girl, Asia. She goes into this high-rise apartment building owned by a bunch of rich people. It's like very exclusive. Also happens to be a satanic cult that controls everything.
Jesus.
And they have to like sacrifice somebody. I guess on the regular. So they generally like put out ads to have maids come in and they'll sacrifice one of them occasionally. Asia is there because she has found out that her sister was brought there and she's there to rescue her sister. So these goofy rich people like try to kill her and she's ready for them. And then it becomes kind of like a hunt through this high-rise apartment. It's done on a much lower budget, I think, than Ready or Not. It's fun enough. Again, this is a movie that I thought like it starts out real well. It's very clear that the director is Kirill Sokolov. He's this Russian director. He loves Kill Bill. Like a lot of like the fights in the beginning are very stylized in like particularly like the end of Kill Bill, the like version what episode one or volume one or whatever it is. So like that it all kind of has that. It also has this weird kind of like you said Marvel-ish humor.
Yeah.
And it coming off with like kind of the same type of plot of like the satanic cabal needing to sacrifice somebody and that person fighting back and succeeding against them. It's the same fucking thing. Like, it was like I'm watching the same thing, but like on a lower budget. Some of it's more fun, like some of the humor is. Like some of the one-liners are catchy. Some of the sequences that he does are neat. There's you can't kill these people, so like if she kills them, they come back to life, not immediately, but it takes a while. So she like blows the head off of this one chick, but the body is still chasing her. Like so, it's like headless with just like some like eye sockets that are growing back. Chasing after her, but can't see her. And then, like, the eyeball, there's a scene where, like, this eyeball is chasing her because she's blown it out of a socket, but it is, like, still following behind, keeping track of her. And there's some cool scenes with, like, the eyeball rolling and the, like, the nerve endings on the end of it kind of just, like, plopping. But that's it. Like, it's the same type of film as Ready or Not 2. Or Ready or Not, it's kind of just becoming the samey thing. And I think it coming out so close to Ready or Not 2 killed it. Like it did not do well this past weekend. Yeah. I don't think it'll be in the theater for very long, but it's fine. Much like Ready or Not 2, it's fine.
Yeah.
And then finally, I saw the movie everyone is loving. It's the first, I think, big box office success of the year. Project Hail Mary, directed by Lord and Miller, who I thought they had been involved in a whole lot more films. They are involved. They've been involved in a whole. I thought they directed a whole lot, more films. They have not. I guess not actually directed a film since 22 Jump Street in 2014, but like their name is on everything. Like they're Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse movies and all the Lego movies. They've all been part of that. And I just thought that they were out there directing shit.
There's kind of the gurus behind the scenes and they write some of it. And
very prolific producers. They've been writing some stuff. But yeah, this is the first movie that they have directed in 12 years. And It is also another adaptation of an Andy Weir novel. And he is the guy who wrote The Martian, which is another kind of like hard sci-fi film that everybody loves.
Yeah,
I too like The Martian quite a bit. I think Project Hail Mary is great. I think it's visually looks fantastic. I guess everybody knows there is like an alien buddy in this film, right? Like that was part of the trailers. So there's an alien rock buddy. They name him Rocky. We find out like he has a mate, and his language isn't the same as our language. So like he says stuff, and then Grace, Ryan Gosling's character, he like just interprets it in English, and he names his mate Adrian. So Rocky and Adrian. There's actually they use a shot of Rocky in the film at one point. Anyway, yeah, great. Rocky is a really fun little like alien buddy. He is also on a mission to save Earth. Oh, not Earth. He's on a mission to save his planet. Grace is on a mission to save Earth because the sun is dying. And the book has way more science in it than this does, but I think this does a great job of like getting to the emotional core of what the book was. It's also visually quite beautiful. Sounds great. Good soundtrack. There are some good flashbacks to kind of like piece together the story. I absolutely loved it. It's currently my favorite film of the year. Great.
I'm going to try to see it this weekend.
I hope you like it. I know you didn't like The Martian as much as...
I wasn't like goo-goo gaga about it like other people, but I thought it was fine. Like, I think I should rewatch it because now I'm like super into space shit. I love that For All Mankind show and all that. So like I should rewatch The Martian. But yeah, I'm excited to see Project Hail Mary. We just couldn't get to it on opening weekend. And then last weekend, we went to the movie actually with my wife's sister and her kids, and her kids wanted to see Ready or Not. That's the only reason I saw Ready or Not. I didn't give a fuck. I truly didn't care. I saw the first one. I was like, that's all I needed. That was good. But yeah, I'm hoping to, because I'm on vacation now. So it's like starting right now. So I'm hoping to get some point this weekend to go see Project Hail Mary. I have a feeling I'm going to love it. Like it. Yeah.
My
one coworker hated it because it's Disney-fied. It's too much like E.T. The thing that cracks me up about my coworker, and I'm not trying to make fun of him, because if he listens, I'm not making fun of you, dude. Just saying. He hated Predator Badlands, which I thought was awesome, by the way. It's another movie I saw this last month. For the same reason. But I'm like, all right, you can't really say that, dude, if you go to see every Marvel movie the opening night. Like, come on, dude.
Legitimately Disney-fied.
Yeah.
I don't think Project Hail Mary is Disney-fied at all. Like, it's pretty true to, like, outside of the fact that, like, you don't see Grace actually doing the science, like, for the most part. Like, the book can expand on it, right? Like, it can allow, here's what the actual science is. Nobody wants to watch a dude in a spacesuit do science experiments, like, for an hour. Like,
or get a lecture on science, like scientific details, and
right, like, yeah, and The Martian is very similar. Like, if you read that book, they go into kind of like the potato farm and how he comes up with how to survive that, and they do the science in the book, and there's more of it, but the adaptations like strip that away because you can't show it in a film, like, because it would be boring and it would take too long.
Yeah, it's like maybe you could do it in a TV show.
Yeah.
Or certain TV shows. Like The Pitt has so much medical jargon and stuff. And like, I'd say 80-85% of it's going over my head. And I just accept it and grab what I can onto it. What the hell else was I thinking of? I don't know. Something else that does the same thing. But Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think you could work that better into a show. That a movie, you kind of have to hit the emotional beats and keep the audience engaged, and yeah.
And so you not having read the book, I'll be interested to hear what you like. I, from what I've heard, everybody that's seeing it kind of loves it.
Yeah.
You know, book or no book, but I am interested to hear what you have to say. Having not read the book, like,
yeah,
if it kind of hits the same high points as well.
I'm excited to see it. Do you like it more or less than The Martian?
I think I like it a little bit more than The Martian. The Martian, though, and I love Matt Damon as an actor, but The Martian is very much just like there are stuff happening on Earth, like to you know, how we're going to rescue him on there. But like a lot of it is just like Matt Damon on Mars by himself.
Process.
This Grace, Ryan Gosling's character, is alone, but then this like little alien buddy shows up. And so it becomes like this buddy movie almost. And there's a little more personality in it. Also, Ryan Gosling, fantastic. Like, he also has a ton of charisma. Rocky is great. Like, I think everybody that has seen him has fallen in love with him.
Which is crazy because he doesn't even have a face, right? It's just like a rock.
He's just this little rock dude.
Does he talk? He talks, right? He's trans.
Yeah, so like so that takes a longer time in the book, but they find a way to like very quickly make it so that basically Rocky can talk. Like, just like there is a technical reason why we can hear him. And they explain it, and like they do it pretty quickly, and it's just like, all right, now Rocky talks, like now we can understand him. And I think that works, like, because you don't want to spend 40 minutes like on Grace trying to figure out the language of this rock thing. Like, so they like show how it happens, and then it's just, all right, it happened, and now we move on, and now Rocky can talk. It's fun. I had a ton of fun with it. I think this year is going to be fucking phenomenal with sci-fi films. We have Spielberg coming up later this. Like, I am super excited for Disclosure Day. I am not a huge Dune fan, but I know people are super excited for Dune Chapter 3. Prestige sci-fi. Is here in 2026.
I don't know if you consider it sci-fi, but you see the new David Robert Mitchell movie that's coming out that looks like a Spielberg movie. It's called like The House at the End of Oak Street.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. I thought that guy was doing a sequel to It Follows. Apparently he's still doing it, but like in between he did a Spielberg movie. Mm-hmm. it looks just like a Spielberg movie to me. It looks awesome. Like, people have like dinosaurs down the street.
And then earlier this year, we got Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die, which is also a sci-fi movie. Like, I just think 2026 is delivering on the fun sci-fi stuff.
Hey, we got new For All Mankind as well, which took 2 years. Yep. So there's that too. Yeah. Yep. I guess you could maybe call Nirvana the band sci-fi.
Sure. there's time travel in it.
It is time travel. So if you consider time travel sci-fi. Yeah. Cool. Hey, you made remind me of one other thing I wanted to talk about.
Yeah.
So Kill Bill.
Uh-huh.
You heard about this whole bloody affair or whatever.
Yeah, they basically stitched it all together for one big long film. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I bought it, I watched it. Look, it's still a great movie. I think like Kill Bill is like one of his best movies, and I think it's one of the best movies of the century, whatever. And none of this hurts that, but like, I just don't prefer this version of it. I just don't. Like, it feels like a marathon to watch it. Like, it's really long, dude. It's like four and a half hours long.
Yeah, that's a long time.
And like, I liked Kill Bill the way it was. Like, volume one, volume two, you split it up over two nights or whatever. It's perfect. So that like alone hurt it, because it was like I was just like, oh my god, could this end already? Especially with the second half being much slower than the first.
Mm-hmm.
But then they're like, oh, we're fixing all the things that like all the compromises he had to make. We're taking that stuff away and putting it back in the way he wanted to do it. And I just don't feel like any of the changes here, like, really, who cares? Like, honestly, most of them, like, I think most of the compromises he made to get Volume 1 and 2 back in the day made those better movies ever so slightly. Like, it's just, like, little things, like, well, because it was split into 1 and 2, he put a cliffhanger at the end of Volume 1 where Kill Bill has a line where he's like, does she know that her daughter is still alive? And I've always loved that cliffhanger. I think it's like an incredible way to end the movie. Yeah. And here that line of dialogue's removed. And I'm like, well, I get why you would do that if it's one movie. So you could have it be a surprise that her daughter's still alive at the end. But I like things the way they were. Maybe I'm an old man. I like things the way they were. Like, there's another part where when she's fighting all the dudes in the bar, that big scene where she kills like 100 dudes or whatever. There's a part in the original version where it goes into black and white, and he did that because he needed to get an R rating, and it was so violent. But seeing it in color here, I was like, whatever. Like, I like that they went into black and white in the old version. I think she does it when she pulls the guy's eye out, and it goes into black and white. I always thought it was a cool touch that it went to black and white. Like, a lot of things that like were compromises back then, I didn't know were compromises. And I just love the movie. And like, so the changes here, I'm just like, I just don't care about them. And I didn't like watching it in one sitting. And I guess the major big change is like, there's an animated sequence, like showing the origin of Lucy Liu.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on longer here. It shows her killing one more person, like she's getting revenge for her parents. And it's pretty long. It's like a long elevator scene with her killing this guy. But at some point, it was like, I get why they cut it. At some point, it's just adding to the running times. So, I mean, if you love Kill Bill, it's interesting to watch this version of it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just didn't need it. And I don't think I prefer it. I think I prefer Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Okay. I might check that out. I do like Kill Bill. We've had this discussion probably multiple times. I prefer Volume 1. I don't like the ending of... It's not that I don't like the ending of 2. It is. You mentioned it. Like, 2 is a slower...
Yeah.
A much slower film. And I think, like, the last 40 minutes of that movie are, like... basically like a conversation between
it's
the two.
Literally, dude, it's literally an hour.
An hour long.
I was like always like, because this time when I was watching it, when they get to like she's going to meet Bill, I was like, okay, how much more is left? I know it's probably a half hour conversation. I paused it. It's 1 hour.
Wow.
But that hour has really grown on me over the years. Like, I think it's really great, but it's like weird. It's just weird because like the end of Volume 1 feels like the climax of a movie, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And then this, it kind of inverts your expectations. Like, and I love that about it, but watching it all as one thing is like very,
yeah.
It's like a marathon. It's like, okay, dude, like, I think it's better when you watch Volume 1, give it a day, watch Volume 2, and then a conversation, like, you're not, like, waiting for it to end. Like, you're more... I think what makes a conversation is, what's his name? David Carradine?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's his name. Yeah, he is just so good as Bill, and, like, you know, he's going on about Superman and shit. it's just... And the other thing is, like, Uma Thurman is so fucking fantastic in the movie. And just seeing them bar verbally is awesome. But, like, yeah, I prefer part one. I think I prefer part one, but I still really love part two.
But, anyways, yeah, I mean, like, if you were to, like, hey, we put these together, I mean, 4.5 hours is a chunk of time. But yeah, it's like, I just wouldn't choose to watch volume two probably on the regular. So
yeah. Oh, I hear you.
All right. Well, so that's what we've been watching, which brings us to our main event, a pair of Stephen King adaptations, spaced apart by a decade. 1983's The Dead Zone and 1993's The Dark Half, also directed by a pair of horror icons, with David Cronenberg doing The Dead Zone and George Romero doing The Dark Half. We're going to kick off with The Dead Zone from 1983.
If the future were in your hands.
The daughter's screaming. The house is burning.
Would you change it?
It's not too late.
Touch this man's hand, and you are in the grip of the Dead Zone.
I've had another episode.
Only the imagination of author Stephen King could take you there.
Johnny, wait!
With a power that alters the future lives of those you love.
You want to kill your own son?
I want you out of here.
I'm scared, Dad.
Or of those you fear.
I have had a vision that I am going to be president of the United States someday, and nobody,
I mean nobody,
gonna stop me.
Is it a power for good or for evil?
If God has seen fit to bless you with this gift, you should use it.
Bless me?
You're a devil. Son of a man.
Who are you?
Who sent you?
I'm scared, son.
What's happening to me?
We're gonna get married, Johnny. Don't leave me, please.
Didn't you see how clear it all is? Not only can you see the future,
I can change it.
Skeleton! 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 Skeleton!
I was there. I saw it.
Put your hand on the scanning screen and you'll go down in history with me.
I saw his face. I stood there. I did nothing.
Johnny!
Stephen King, The Dead Zone.
Released in October of 83. Didn't do amazing, but it was okay. Had a budget about between 7 to 10 million per Wikipedia, and it made maybe about 35 million along with video rentals over the course of its life. So it did good. It's not an amazing, amazing blockbuster, but
and this one hangs in the public consciousness more than The Dark Half. Like, people don't really talk about The Dark Half.
It does, and it's weird. Yeah. Well, I guess we'll get to that. But based on a Stephen King novel of the same name, the novel was from 1979. This film has a cast of people that you probably know just by me saying them right here: Christopher Walken, Tom Skerritt, Martin Sheen. They're all in this. They're all like named people that you could probably visualize in your head as people there. Have you ever read the Dead Zone book, Jeff?
No, I've never read either of these, and I've read a lot of Stephen King books, but yeah. he has so many. And sometimes, like, so I got into Stephen King around when I was like 10 years old, so it would have been like in the 90s, right? And I kind of tended to stay away from the books that had adaptations. So, like, I've never read The Shining because
you saw
I always had the movie or the miniseries. And I think these two, I never read the books because I'm like, I could just watch the movies. Now, there's a few where I've read Carrie. I've read, everything he's done has been adapted at this point. But yeah, these two, one, I don't think I ever got, like, I saw these when I was little, like, both these movies. Probably the last time I saw these movies was when I was little, and neither of them I really understood. And so it would have been like, yeah, I already know what's going to happen. I also didn't really get the movie. Do I want to read the book? So no, I did not read either of these.
Okay. So I've only read The Dead Zone, which I read this past year.
Okay.
Actually, only because I've gotten into Stephen King's son's books, Joe Hill.
Yeah.
And, a recent book he released called King Sorrow actually has like what Joe Hill has started to do is incorporate Stephen King's universe into his like locations, characters. Like he's basically continuing on. Cause if you've read Stephen King, a lot of his stuff interconnects.
Yeah.
Like the, it's kind of like a shared universe, the Kingiverse, if you will. I hate that term, but it is what people utilize. And Joe Hill has now kind of taken that, and his books belong in that as well as he continues on. His dad, though, continues to release books at a rapid clip, like at least one or two a year. But anyway, that's the reason I read The Dead Zone, because it's referenced in the new Joe Hill book. And we'll get to my feelings on the book versus this at some point. But yeah, plot of this movie is a teacher, Johnny Smith, very generic name.
Yeah.
He's like dating another teacher, and they end up, you know, going to her house. He has proposed to her, I guess, so they're engaged.
And even though they have not fucked, I don't like.
I'm
a little confused. what is this?
So yes, that is a plot point in the book as well.
Is that the same as the book? They have not fucked.
They haven't. Now there is differing reasons. I don't know what the reason here is. I think they just took that plot point and stuck it. So in the book, Sarah gets sick, and like he's planning on like this is the night we're gonna do it, and she gets sick while they're out, like very very sick. And but similarly, there's like something going on outside, and she's like, why don't you just stay here? And he goes, no. But this one, it's like raining, and he like gives her a kiss. He's like, it's some things are better worth waiting for. I think that's what he says to her.
But it's like, it's weird to me, because it's like, if you're getting married, you've never fucked? Like, that I just felt like some of the relationship stuff in this doesn't make sense. Like maybe if you're like ultra Christian or like in an arranged marriage, but like most normal people fuck before they got married, you know? Like
in the book, like they've only gone out, like they've only been going out for like maybe three or four times. Like they're new in the relationship in the book. In this one, they're engaged. Like they're going to get married. He goes home, he gets in his car to go home. And on his way home, he ends up in a very catastrophic car crash.
The most unconvincing car crash ever.
So like, ridiculous.
Doesn't look good. Like, I don't know. You see this thing there. You just drive right into it. Okay.
It's very bad. Like the way it's framed, like this tractor trailer, the driver falls asleep, which is a thing that happens. Like, somehow his trailer comes unhooked and it is just sliding down the highway. Not even a highway, just like this back country road in Maine sideways. So it's taking up all the lanes. And Johnny, I don't know why he wasn't paying attention, because this is
clearly visible. Like,
he is wiping his window, I think. Like it was raining.
So, okay, but come on.
But still, you should be able to see it. Like it's lit up. and he drives right into this thing. He does swerve like at the last minute, but ridiculous explosion. Sarah rushes to the hospital and is like, oh, please, Johnny, please, like, don't leave me. And it picks up, I think, four or so years later, 4.5 years later, he has been in a coma all this time. And when he wakes up, he has psychic abilities.
Hell yeah.
If you touch him. If you touch him, he like gets glimpses of things. A fire in a nurse's house, he like saves her daughter. He is able to see that his doctor's mom, who he thought had left him behind, I think they show it as the what war is it in this one?
I think it's the Holocaust, like it's the invasion of
Poland. It is still World War II, which is what it is in the book. It's a
also the doctor's reaction to finding this all out. I was like, there's certain things in this movie where it doesn't ring true on a human level. Like the doctor finding out his mother's alive, and he goes, "Hey, did you call her?" He's like, "Yeah, but I hung up." And he's like, "Why?" Because it wasn't meant to be. It's like, that's not how a human. I don't know if you agree, but
yeah, absolutely. No, that I agree. Also, straight from the book, though, that is it. That is so a direct weird. Adaptation. So Johnny
that like
has
a, that felt like a Cronenberg thing to me. But I guess what's in the book? Okay.
Yeah. No. Yeah, like that. That is from the book where the doctor leaves his mom. Who
is like, wouldn't you want to meet your mom? Like,
right.
Like,
So yeah, he has these psychic abilities where he can kind of like see glimpses into the future. Sometimes just like moments into the future. Sometimes a little bit further. He ends up having, I guess because he saves this nurse, he ends up having a press conference at the hospital, and a reporter's like trying, basically like, I'm trying to prove that this guy's a fraud. So he's like being a little bit of a jerk to him, and he touches him, and he starts telling him things about his dead sister and he's like, no, stop. Like it gets out of hand. Like, so now Johnny has like bad press or whatever. He doesn't want any of this. He just wants to kind of like recover and move on with his life. Because Sarah has moved on with her life. She not only is no longer with Johnny, who, to be fair, was in a coma. They told him he wasn't ever coming out of it. She has hooked up with some dude who's a I believe he's like a what would you call them? He like goes around to like get
canvasser.
Yeah, he's a canvasser. He's a campaign.
I've done it.
Mm-hmm. So she's married, not just hooking up with this dude. She's married him and has a like 2-year-old kid. So she has completely moved on with her life. They bring her back into it where she comes and visits Johnny, and then they fuck like at his house.
I don't understand. Like, look, like I was into like the actual story and the drama here. Like, right. Mm-hmm. Like, but again, like there's certain character behaviors in this that I just, it feels like alien to me. And I took it as Cronenberg, but, one was like the doctor not wanting to meet his mom. I was like, that's insane. And two, this part is insane. She like visits him on Christmas and fucks him. And then she's like, yeah, we're never doing that again. I was like, oh, I thought you were like leaving your husband to come back. Like you changed your mind. And even that seems unrealistic to me. The most realistic thing is that she moved on and had a kid, right? That seems the most realistic to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially like since the doctors are going, she's never coming back. Right, like he's not coming back. He's done.
But to go back, like, and fuck the guy seems cruel to do.
So, Cronenberger's King. Where do you think that falls?
It just feels so alien, and Stephen King is not alien. Like he seems to understand people. So I put it on Cronenberg.
Stephen King. That happens in the book.
I just found that part like it was okay. I was like, okay, well, I guess maybe she's like. Realize
it is.
Should go back with him, whatever.
Yeah,
but she's just like, that's never gonna happen again. I'm like, then why did you come do it? Like, that's such a cruel thing to do to this guy who's recovering. Like, You know what I mean? Like,
and it is. So she does that same thing, basically. Like, yeah, like I wanted to do this forever, and I never thought we'd get the chance, but it's the only time we could ever do it, and that's where our life ends together. Like that, at that moment, like we got to fuck, I guess, yay. But I have a life. I'm not leaving my husband. I have a son.
Yeah, have fun being like a cripple with fucking psychic powers where you see bad shit and see ya, buddy. But you at least got to hit that pussy.
Right. So Johnny kind of spirals after this. Not right after. So he then somehow gets involved in a murder investigation. This is where Tom Skerritt comes in. They come and ask him, hey, can you help? We know that you're this psychic. You've been able to do some shit. Can you help us? And Skerritt doesn't really believe it, but he's just trying whatever because there's a serial killer in his small town. And ultimately, Johnny does solve it. It happens to be a deputy of that police station that's been doing it. But after that, Johnny starts to spiral like badly. Like he no longer lives with his dad, because his mom has died. They don't play up the mom in the movie as much as they do in the book. She's actually a religious nut in the book. And they kind of kill her off pretty quickly here. Like, I think she like touches his hand and he's like, oh, and he like sees her death, and then that's it. That's the end of it. He spirals though and leaves town, ends up somewhere else. He's like tutoring. He's like gone back to teaching. He's tutoring children out of a house. He gets a vision of one of his students falling into a pond.
Nice. Is gonna break.
Yeah. So this is funny because this is changed from the book. He does tutor in the book, but the whole ice hockey pond thing breaking is like the opening scene with Johnny. Like, as he's like a young kid, he's like 5 or 6 years old, and he hits his head. And this is where he kind of like originally has the powers. And it's not from the car accident. And in this, they make it this like weird thing where this kid falls through the ice and he knows what's going to happen. He has to basically scare the kid into not going. The dad still wants to go. But the kid says, fuck off. I'm not going out on that ice.
Good on the kid. Good on the kid.
Yeah. The kid believes his teacher. And some other kids do go and they do fall through the ice, though. And then I don't really understand how he ends up like he shakes hands with this politician and realizes he's going to cause the end of the world.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
And his choice there, not that it's not his, like he decides I have to stop this. I know that if I let this guy, you know, continue on, he's eventually going to become president of the United States. He's a psychopath and he's going to destroy the world.
It's the age old question. And they bring it up in this. They bring it up. He goes to his doctor and he's like, if you knew, like, if you could go back in time and kill Hitler as a baby, would you do it? Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean that's basically it. Like he knows this guy is going to destroy the world, so he goes takes him out first. And that's it. That's
the death zone. Well, tries to take him out, but does not. He gets killed.
And, yes,
but the politician grabs a baby as a shield, and that ruins his political career. Yeah.
That's, yes. Yeah. His political career is ruined because he uses a child as a human shield, which is true to the book too.
But would that happen today? Would anyone leave? Would Trump's approval go down if that happens? Like, oh no, it makes sense. You gotta grab the meat to protect your the meat shield.
Yeah, and I can guarantee that a certain politician would grab a small child and put them in front of him.
But there would be people defending it today. There would be people like, well, he's more important.
Right.
What has this kid done?
It's wild, right? I mean, this was done in this film was 1983. The book was 1979. It was a different world than for sure. Like, but yeah. So that's the Dead Zone. I've read your Letterboxd review of this, and you commented that it felt episodic.
Yes.
You want to expand on that?
Yeah, because, all right, well, there is, like, throughout it, it's him, like, recovering and dealing with what happened with his girlfriend and this and that. But it just feels like it goes from episode to episode to episode of him solving stuff for people.
Yep.
And that Greg Stilson, the politician, he, like, looms in the background of the whole movie. But he's really not introduced to, like, well an hour into the movie when we first meet him. And I just felt like that should have been built up more as a thing throughout. Not just like the background, but like we should have seen more of Martin Sheen. Like we get one scene of Martin Sheen blackmailing somebody and like telling them he'll fucking kill him if they don't do what he says.
Yep.
Which is, I guess, gets to the point. But like it just feels like a series of episodes of this guy solving problems. And then it lands on this really cool one at the end. But I felt like that one at the end should have been... I could see Cronenberg trying to build that up throughout, but I don't know. It just felt like, yeah, like that. Like it was just like a series of adventures or whatever. Like, and then we land on the coolest one.
I agree. I will say in the book, in the novel, they build Stilson up way more. Like, in fact, I believe Stilson is the first character you actually. If I don't know if it's the ice skating scene or if it's Stilson, but there's a scene with Stilson like right at the
very
beginning
early,
where it's like he's a bad dude. Like,
yeah, like I would have almost liked like we're tracking these two characters throughout it, and instead
and that's how the book kind of does it is like obviously Johnny is the more prominent character, but we do get like snippets of Stilson and his rise to power through politics and like what he's been doing over the course of time. And then we get a little bit more of like his shady dealings, like outside of just the blackmail, like, you know, he's sending people to beat people up. He's blackmailing people. He's like utilizes these basically like Hell's Angels as his security, his private security, and they beat up like anybody that like opposes to him in the book. Like he's very clearly like an evil fucking dude. But this movie is only like an hour and 40 minutes.
Yeah. Like it gets the point across of who he is, but it just feels like it arrives on what the main plot should be in the last 20 minutes. Like that's just how I feel about it. Yeah.
And the back end of the book, like probably like the last quarter of the book is Johnny basically becomes obsessed with Greg Stilson.
That's what I need more build up to like that. Yeah. I appreciate that it was not that long because like, again, I think the other movie we're going to talk about, I think it was too long, but like, I needed more. Yeah, like that would have been great. Like him getting obsessed with Stilson and be like, "No one will listen to me," or like, you know what I mean? Like, this guy is not good. Like, and then him finally deciding that he has to do it instead of like he has one conversation with his doctor about Hitler and he's like, "Yep, well, I guess that's what I got to do." Like, I don't know. It just feels like episodes. Like that's
It feels like episodes. And for me, and this is on me because I just read the book. It felt like a speed run. Of everything, like it's all very true to the book. Like they change some things here and there, but it's like a speed run of everything. It's like I wish there was more time to breathe on some of the points. Instead, it's
this
like
a good limited series, like a good episode.
Well, but I'm gonna circle back on that comment. But what are your final thoughts on this movie, Jeff?
I actually like it. I do like it. I think Walken's performance is good, even though, like, and when you first see him and he's his teacher, it was hard for me to take him seriously because I'm just so used to him being, like, comedic. Mm-hmm. But I thought Walken's performance is good. Sheen was good. I thought, actually, everyone was good in it. It's very low-key. It's very... It feels minor and just muted and kind of slow and... But... And it feels like very restrained Cronenberg. Like, we get almost none of this. Like,
yes.
There's one part where a guy like goes to fall on a pair of scissors and he doesn't even show it.
Yep. So, where'd you watch this at, Jeff?
I rented it from Prime Video.
Okay. So, that's, I was wondering because I watched it on YouTube and okay. It was free. And like they had a thing at the beginning that was like, this has been edited for your TV. If content in your TV, and it's like, did I get like the TV cut? Like, but,
nah,
but
I mean, there's nothing in it. There's nothing in it. Here's the thing. Like, even though I thought it was episodic, I was still into the story. Like, I was into this guy. Like, I felt bad for this guy. Like, he went through something terrible. He's recovering from a coma. And there's an awesome part where he says to his ex, like, for you, it's been 5 years. For me, we were about to get married yesterday. Like, and, like, that, like, so, like, I was, like, really into all that. And I really love where the ending goes. Like, I think that's cool. I just felt like, I needed more room to breathe. Like, I'm not saying that I wanted it to be a longer movie. I just either like you had to be building as a sidetrack Martin Sheen more, or this would have been a better like as a miniseries.
Which often is the case with Stephen King stuff. It's like his stuff doesn't necessarily translate well to 90 to 2 hours, 90 minutes.
I mean, some people figured I get it. This is an easier one, but I thought The Long Walk was fantastic. Now, that's a shorter story.
Yeah,
it's easier to get into a 2-hour movie, but yeah, this part of this is it's old, it's a little dated now, so like it's gonna hit us different watching it like 50 years later, whatever. But and at the end of the day, like I like it. It's not one I'm gonna return to a bunch, but like I dig the story and I dig where it ended. I actually gonna land kind of high on it and say like a 7.
Okay. I'm lower than you on it. I'm gonna land at a 5 on this. But I really do think my reading the book spoiled kind of the film for me.
Yeah.
Just because like if
you just read it too.
Yeah. And it feels like a speed run of the book. So I was like, a little side note here on the movie itself that I didn't mention at the beginning, Deborah Hill produced this.
I saw that.
So a little Halloween tie here. And you mentioned this would work better as maybe a limited series. What about a 6-season?
No, are you serious?
There is a 6-season adaptation of Stephen King's The Dead Zone. I watched the first 2 episodes of it.
Has to go beyond the book.
It goes way beyond the book because basically by the end of, and they've changed so much too, because it takes place, I think when he crashes his car, it is the 90s. And when he wakes up, George Bush is president, the second. So it takes place in like the 2000s. So they've upped the timeline. They've changed some pieces of the story around.
How is there 6 seasons of a show I've never heard of?
It was on USA.
Oh, that's fine.
Yeah. And that wasn't, I've heard of the show. I never watched it. Anthony Michael Hall plays Johnny. so he's Johnny in this. I've watched the first 2 episodes. They do things in this adaptation that are more true to the book, and it's given more breathing time as well.
Funny.
There's a big scene in the beginning of the book is Sarah and Johnny go to this carnival, and at the carnival he like plays like one of those money wheel games. And the money wheel guy is like being a dick to like the customers coming up. So he uses his powers basically to steal the money back from the money wheel guy. He's not stealing, he's winning, but he like knows the numbers to choose. So like that is played in here. They do change some other things though. Sarah, his girlfriend, she does remarry, but she marries the sheriff. because what the Dead Zone becomes after episode one is a police procedural. It becomes basically like Johnny's gonna use those powers every week to help solve a crime.
Oh my god. That's very USA sounding.
Absolutely. It is trash TV. But I enjoyed the first two episodes. I may use it as like when I'm working, like just put it on as background noise.
What's going on here? Yeah.
Yep. But yeah, it's very, very, very 2000s, very USA coded.
That's crazy.
But yeah, there's a whole TV series that lasted for six seasons from 2002 to 2007. 80 episodes of this.
Holy shit. And I never, I've heard of USA shows that I've never watched. I've never heard of that one.
They bring in the whole, who's the politician guy, Stilson.
Yeah.
He comes into this at some point. Like he is kind of like a background character. So they're going to build him up over six seasons. He's played by Sean Patrick Flannery. yeah, crazy.
I have to imagine though, like season one ends like how the book ends, and then they just keep doing shit. Like I don't know, like
yeah,
unless they're gonna build like, up to it over six seasons. That would be too much time to get this story out. Like I don't know.
Yeah, I think that probably makes the most sense. Get to like the Stilson
book at
the end of season one, and then in the next five seasons, like it just becomes. Procedural.
The Handmaid's Tale, like season one, adapted the book, and then it's just like we're just gonna keep this going and see where it goes. And they did it.
So the sex scene, in the movie and the book, where you know Sarah comes over, and he has a vision that so like they play it out, like you get to see this happen, like him hooking up with her. But then it's just like a vision that he has, and he's like, "Tara, I think you should leave." And then he does that line with, "It's been, I think in this they play it as 6 years." He's like, "It's been 6 years for you, but it's only been like a couple days for me." it's like maybe until I get over these feelings, you shouldn't come to my house by yourself. Yeah, so. That's out there. That exists. It's on Tubi as well. So if anybody is interested in checking that nonsense out, it's there. So that brings us to our other half of it. The darker half, I guess. 1983's George Romero directed The Dark Half.
Thad Beaumont has a secret.
I know all about it.
A piece of himself he keeps hidden.
You just don't want to give up George. You become attached to him.
Locked away until he needs it.
These behaviors could be interpreted as schizophrenia.
Away from the light, safe in the shadows.
I wrote those words, and I have no recollection of doing it.
But sometimes, secrets take on a life of their own. Thad Beaumont thought he didn't need George Stark anymore.
The American way of death.
That's it.
He served his purpose. Time to lay him to rest. But George is not about to go quietly.
You really don't realize what you're like when you write those books, do you? It's like watching Jekyll turn into Hyde.
We're here to question you in connection with a capital crime.
Evidence says you did it.
George Stark has somehow come to life.
Hello, George.
I've come closer to believing a ghost story than this. You're talking about a man who never was.
No! He wants to take over your life. Can't you see that?
Based upon a book by Stephen King comes George A. Romero's masterful vision of a nightmare come true.
Are you ready?
Just waiting on you.
The Dark Half.
Based on Stephen King's 1989 novel of the same name. This one came out in April of 93. It had a budget of $15 million, so higher budget than The Dead Zone, and it bombed at the box office. $10 million was what its take was. Not great. Critical reception was mixed. It seems like it was fine. Fine. Roger Ebert gave it 2 out of 4 stars. Stars Timothy Hutton as Thad Beaumont, Amy Madigan as Liz Beaumont, and Michael Rooker as the sheriff. Yeah, that's the base cast right there. There's some stuff in this, I guess we'll get there as we kind of move on. I have not read this book. Jeff, you did not read this book either. As you mentioned, you kind of stayed away from novels that had adaptations. So I knew nothing about this coming in, other than it was based on the book. It stars a writer, which a lot of Stephen King books have writers as characters. He often either puts a version of himself in, or in some cases just straight up puts himself in his books. But this is it's about a writer, Thad Beaumont. He is a teacher at a local college, and he writes like literature, like highbrow, high-end literature that nobody wants to read. But he also writes under a pen name, George Stark, and George Stark writes trash, like dark, seedy crime novels.
Pulp fiction, if you will.
Yeah. Yes. Very much. And this guy figures out somehow, by talking to somebody at the publisher, that Thad Beaumont is George Stark. And he basically blackmails him, says, you know, if you don't pay me a bunch of money, I'm going to release that you are George Stark.
Go ahead. The central conceit of this, that conceit, I'm just like, I don't get it. Because, like, okay, he reveals he's that guy. So what? He can still write George Stark novels, or just write George Stark novels with his name, and people will be along for the ride. Like I don't get how that's a piece of blackmail where, like, you would seriously give a fuck what they, like. And the guy does kind of, like, the main, you know, Timothy Hutton kind of brushes it off here, but it's the main conceit of the movie is that, like, this guy is going to expose him. And so, like, he has to respond to it somehow.
And
is that believable to you? Like, it's not believable to me.
So, I don't think it's believable. But also, I don't know the literary, like, you know, the publishing world of the 1980s, especially when Stephen King was there. I do very much remember reading about, and so this is where it's very similar, straight up to Stephen King, right? There's Stephen King. He writes his Stephen King novels, and then he has a pen name that Jeff and I are familiar with, Richard Bachman. And he releases books under this Richard Bachman moniker. They are slightly different from what King normally writes. The reasoning that King has given for the Bachman pen name is that publishers didn't want to release multiple books by one author over the course of a year. So King, very prolific. Like, he is a writer that can deliver two full length novels, like huge novels too. Like, we're talking 400, 500, 600 pages in the course of a year. And publishers were saying, no, like, we want The Stand. And if you want to write another book, you have to like come up with a different name, because people aren't going to be willing to buy two books from you. I don't find that to be true. Like,
yeah,
I don't buy it. Right. But that was the common thought.
If you like the writer, you're going to buy their next book. Like,
right. Right. Like, I don't care. Right.
Like, oh no, there's two things I like. Oh no.
Oh, double me up.
Like, yeah. Like,
oh no, I can't have two Stephen King novels in one year. But it does seem that like there was this weird conception in the publishing industry about that.
There's also the explanation I've seen him get, not the explanation that for why, but I've seen Stephen King say that he would be more nihilistic writing as Bachman, where like he would not care if he killed the character. Yeah. And so, like, again, as I was watching this, I'm like, I get it. Jesus Christ, I get it. But go ahead.
But again, it is like, why does it matter that this dude is going to release it? Okay. Well, I like George Stark. Who cares if his name is actually Thad Beaumont? Like, I like George Stark's smut. Like,
yeah,
like, more so smut, like, George.
This was a sticking point for me watching it, because it's just like, who cares, dude? Like, who cares? Who cares? Like, I just did not buy that. Like, but whatever.
So if you could get past that, though, which Jeff couldn't. But yeah, so basically they go on this PR campaign to kill George Stark, which is a little ridiculous.
Yeah, we're posing by a grave.
Yeah, like they like have a plot in wherever he's at, like a burial plot, and they go out there. They have a fake gravestone. Him and his wife go pose there. George Stark is now dead. And immediately after all this, like, that they killed George Stark, the pen name, murders start happening, and they seem to tie to Thad, like his I guess they weren't doing DNA testing, but was like fingerprints matched, the description kind of matches.
It's all people connected to him.
Yeah, it's all, especially all people connected to him in regards to this thing that happened, where they were killing George Stark off. And I think the opening of this lays, like, and I didn't know the kind of like the overall narrative. I thought it did lay like a cool idea of maybe like Jekyll and Hyde, where
he's losing
his mind, right?
Like, exactly, dude. Exactly. And
so he's like killing people, because they do like, oh, well, you
were in New York, and someone in New York died. Like,
yeah, like right after you left, or right around when you left. Like, I mean, and you weren't meeting with anybody during that time. You were supposedly in New York, but that doesn't mean you couldn't have driven this car and killed this other guy. So, like, there's like some neat things there. There's more Stephen King to it than like this Jekyll Hyde thing, though, because George Stark, this imaginary pen name, has actually come to life, and it is because of I think it's hysterical and I love it. It is Thad, when he was conceived, he was conceived as twins. Like, there were twins in the womb, and in the womb he ate his twin. This happens. This is a real thing that happens.
I do like that. It's based on a real, like, I think that's neat. Like, yeah.
So like they have this kind of, I don't know, like the the fetus was kind of like evolving at, like it was growing, but it has grown inside Thad's head.
It's basically a tumor in his head.
Yeah.
But it has like eyes and, yeah, but this happens. They'll find teeth in people's head. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're like, oh, like this is, you know, it doesn't have a soul. It's not
the parents
anything.
Bury it, and it's at the plot where they do the fake publicity.
And so George Stark, the pen name, has embodied the remains of Thad's twin. So basically, like a twin of Thad is out there killing people as George Stark. Like they have taken on the personality of this hard-boiled writer. From the south, and he goes on a killing spree while the police just suspect Thad as the killer. And we
fucking
get
Michael Rooker's just staring at Timothy Hutton this whole movie, like, you fucking did this, right?
Yeah,
like,
you're a fucker, man. Like, it's like, why? And it's like, that's what the kind of funny thing is. Like, he won't lock him up, though. Like, I don't. Arrest him, man. Like, just arrest him. And if the murders keep happening,
then you know. I thought the same thing. Like, you put this guy, lock this guy up for 24 hours. If another murder happens, then you know it wasn't him. But he just gives this guy the benefit of the doubt over and over and over. It's so funny.
And so, like, Thad understands what he thinks he understands what's happening. He's like, I think that my creation has. I think my alternate persona, because his wife does say when you write as George, like your personality changes. You're meaner, you drink, like there's a whole bunch of different shifts. And as Thad, he is sober. And his wife actually mentions this at some point in the movie, like, yeah, Thad hasn't drank in 3 years. George drinks, though. So George is a drunk, a mean drunk. He's also a serial killer that is killing all these people related to Thad. And it ultimately ends with a showdown, which is a little ridiculous, in this house.
Right off.
Yeah. And they sit down to write together. And
so ridiculous.
It is. I kind of like it, though, where he's writing, like Thad is writing, and you see George like deteriorating in front of you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then he's like, why don't you try it, George? And George's like, I'm scared. He's like, ah, man, you just gotta do it. And then George starts writing and you see Thad start deteriorating.
Yeah.
Like, I thought there were some cool like effects there. Romero does some neat things. What's basically a pretty simplistic kind of story, right? Like he's doing some
it's
good
very,
effects.
Having a write-off is very uncinematic.
Oh yeah.
Oh, we're gonna have some two guys write against each other at a desk.
Okay. We can't even read what they're writing either. It's just like chicken scratches. So Thad ultimately is able to overcome George gets taken by the crows or the sparrows or whatever. There's some birds that show up. That is a subplot that is kind of
sparrows.
It's set up in the beginning of the movie that this like thing in his head was causing him to hear birds, and also the birds actually did show up like twice. Yeah. They show up when they have the surgery, take the pieces out of his head, and they show up to take George away. And I thought that was a cool sequence too. This was 1993, and they have these like birds attacking George Stark.
Yeah,
and just picking the pieces of flesh off him.
It was the one good kill.
Yeah, yeah. There's no like, really good kills because they're kind of all off to the side, but
it's all knife slitting. Like he walks around with a straight blade and like, slit someone's neck. But that was like one of my big complaints of the movie is like, there's just not good kills and stuff. But like the end was pretty awesome, dude. When these birds are ripping apart, like you get really cool practical effects And then he's turning into like a Jason Argonaut skeleton as the birds are picking him away.
So good.
Pretty good.
But yeah, it's a pretty simplistic story. It does take a little bit longer than the Dead Zone. It clocks in at almost a little over 2 hours long. I think it's like 121 minutes or so. I ultimately liked it. Jeff, where did you end up with it?
I don't hate it, but it's like, it is Stephen King so far up his own ass.
Like, absolutely.
More than like anything. And it's like, I think about as far as you to get up your own ass was The Shining. Like, it's too... Like, I can appreciate it as someone who used to write and, you know, was like, considered myself a creative person where, like, I get what he's going for, but it's also, like, too inside baseball. Like, I could see why it was not a hit. Oh, your inner self and your outer self, and, you know what I mean? There's these two people inside you, and, like, if you don't feed, like, if you don't let, like, the dark side in your stories, then it's going to come out in the real. It's just so on the nose.
It is.
But I think my problem with this movie is it just feels too long. Like, it's just, we get the explanation of that so many times, like five or six times throughout the movie, we get the explanation of like what is going on.
Yeah. We could have cut like maybe two of them.
We don't need it
to drag on. We don't need him explaining to Michael Rooker, no man, really, you gotta believe me, it's my alter ego
that
has manifested somehow.
And like, there's things I like about it. I like the cast. I think Timothy Hutton is actually pretty good in this. I love Michael Rooker. Also, I did not realize that was Amy Madigan. I saw her in the credits, but I did not realize who she was. But yeah, it's too long. There's no good kills until the very end when the bad guy gets killed. And yeah, just kind of Stephen King ruminating on himself a little too much.
Oh yeah, this is definitely him like lamenting the fact that he let Bachman go.
Yeah. It's just too, it's too of him inside his own head. And then the Romero's directing is fine. There are actually parts that I thought the lighting was cool. Like, it had super saturated lighting at points where, like, there's one kill where George Stark is going after someone that's like really red lit. And it reminded me of the lighting that George Romero did on Creepshow, which was kind of more appropriate there because he was trying to do like these big comic booky things. But yeah, like overall, like, I thought it was okay, but it really felt like one of Stephen King's 90s miniseries, but stuffed into a movie. And yeah, like, I didn't hate watching it, but I was getting kind of bored as it went on. Because I was just like, oh man, like, this is just like every Stephen King trope into one here. And we're not getting any good kills. So I get like a 5.5. Like, it's not essential Stephen King adaptation. If you haven't seen it, check it out. Sure. But like, you know, if you saw it back in the day, I would not say like you need to revisit it. Like, there's better versions of this. I don't know. Writers like to do this shit too, by the way. Like, Dean Koontz has a book like it's called like Mr. Murder or something. I'm like, oh, we're so dark. I get it, dude.
Yeah.
I get it.
I mean, and this is something King like revisits multiple times in multiple stories too. So it's not, this isn't the only time he kind of like broaches being a writer, the darkness of writing.
I just think he approaches that better. I've never read The Shining, but I've seen like both adaptations. Like, I just think that's better. It's far less inside baseball about writing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you get what I'm saying? Like, is it, if that makes any sense? Like,
yeah.
Like, I get it. Writing's an outlet for to let your dark impulses come out. But, like, I just think it works better in The Shining. Like, I don't know. Like,
Sure. I mean, I would not say this is better than The Shining by any stretch.
No.
I think I enjoyed it slightly more than you. I had fun with it. I wish that it had been the Jekyll and Hyde thing instead of.
Yes, that's so much better. Than making it literal. Yeah.
It's like, oh, it actually is like a manifestation of your alter ego, not realizing that you're doing this.
Here's the funny thing. So we're watching it, okay? And I've seen the movie before, but I saw it when it first came out, so I don't remember, right? And my wife goes, oh, that baby, you know what it is? The doctors and the scientists like kept that, like the tumor, and they raised it. And so I was like, no. I was like,
she was closer.
What it is. I know. Yeah, she was closer. Basically, what I'm getting to is she was closer than me, because I was like, no, what it is he lost that outlet to like let that. And so now he's doing it. I go, that's what it is. He's the one that's doing it. And she ended up being more right than me that it was physical manifestation.
Yeah. Based from the baby that
it ate. Yeah, little tumors.
That's hysterical. I ultimately liked it. I did like kind of like the crime noir,
Yeah.
Whenever George Stark was around, like that's kind of how it feels like
he reminded me of? What's that? Reminded me of the dude in Twin Peaks The Return, Kyle MacLachlan. He reminded me a lot of that.
Yeah, the evil version.
All in black. Him. Yeah, yep. Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly it, right? Like, there's the good guy version, and then this alternate version that's out there killing people. I had a good time with it. Much like you, I don't think that it is like must watch, but I wonder if I had read the book, if I've been like, don't like this one either. Like,
I don't think I would like the book for this. I just think it's just too familiar to me. Like, I've read too many stories like this. Yeah.
It is. He wrote this in 1989, so it is like right
the height of cocaine.
Yep, it is Cocaine Steve. And this were some of his like most like outlandish, but also kind of like where he's self-indulgent with a lot of it.
Tommy Knockers.
Yeah. So it's like that era of him, which is not considered his best writing period. So
yeah.
I liked it. I'm going to give it a 6 out of 10, which means we are split.
We're at an impasse
on this. Jeff, did we do a poll by chance?
I did not. I thought about doing it like yesterday, but I was like, there's not enough time. Not to be anyone that responds. So I don't know. I guess it's a split decision.
Well, we'll go by score. You gave The Dead Zone a 7, and I gave it a 5, and I gave The Dark Half a 6, and you gave it a 5.5. So we'll side The Dead Zone this one.
Slightly got more points. Yep. Hell yeah.
Jeff, what are we watching for April?
So it's been the last Friday the 13th movie came out in 2009. It has been way too long.
Yes.
So desperate times call for desperate measures. We're going to watch 2 fan films.
Okay.
Never Hike Alone and Never Hike Alone 2.
Never Hike Alone 1 and 2. Where can we watch these, Jeff?
I believe they're both on YouTube. If they're not, okay. I'll fucking switch it up. But I did check about a month ago and they were both on there. Widely regarded as like really great. You know, really great like fan films of you know. About as good as you could hope for, not being official. And also, I believe Tom Matthews is in them, which is like, he played Tommy Jarvis in Jason Lives. So okay. I guess Tommy Jarvis is back in them. Hey, we're going outside the box yet again. And I've always wanted to check these movies out, but now I'm like forcing myself to do it.
All right.
They're both short, Chris. I think they're both like an hour long. So.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah.
We'll and they are fan-made Friday the 13th movies.
Yeah, but somehow he got like actual actors from. I mean, not somehow. I don't think Tom Matthews is waiting for a call from fucking the pit to do an episode. So I think he was available.
Yes. So I just checked. These are both available on YouTube. Never Hike Alone is under an hour, and Never Hike Alone 2 is a little over an hour. So, all right. So we're not hiking alone next
we've
time out.
Reach fan films.